KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org. Good afternoon. This is Lori McGrath, and this is Aging Reimagined. This is a show for people of all ages who are looking ahead to a brighter future, one filled with health and prosperity and adventures. And today I have Michael Gray with me. Michael Gray is the author of a book titled Falling on the Bright Side, which right away is an engaging title to me anyway. Michael lives in Albuquerque, and good morning. I'm sorry, good afternoon. I seem to keep doing that because we're pre-recording this show, folks, and that's why I do that. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Laurie.
It's nice to have you here. I think I'm just going to jump right in. I think there's a lot to talk about with this book. It has a lot of characters and themes woven through it. And starting off just by asking you, what inspired you to write the book, first of all, and then we'll go into the characters and the story.
Actually, it was a rather pedestrian inspiration. I'd written a novel about whales, dolphins, and aliens after a long retreat, and that just sort of came out of me. And then I felt that was kind of fun. That was like nice to have a narrative journey to keep me busy and active. And so I took a class from a writing class from somebody called Paula Paul, an Albuquerque writer. And she was a great fan. She's a great fan of writing an agenda beforehand, like an outline of the book. So, and then she also, I think, encouraged writing from what you know. So at that point, I was working in an organization I founded with my friend Foster to help people with neuromuscular diseases. And so I thought, well, that's the only thing I know, really, in the way of that's the narrative arc of my own life right now. And but that was in the probably the mid to late 90s. So I wrote that kind of quite quickly, I think, in the period of one summer. Tried to get an agent, tried to get a publisher, and I didn't. So then it sat in my garage for 10 or 15 years.
Wow. All right. My initial reading, I came across an article in the Primetime magazine about your book, and it mentioned that it was in part about folks living in a nursing home, and a nursing home as sort of the last stop. And I thought, wow, that's just like really not a that's kind of a grim theme. But I got the book, and I started reading it, and there are all sorts of storylines that run through it. And it really, perhaps it starts there with folks living in a nursing home environment where they are feeling frustrated in terms of what they're able to do, or they're not so happy about it. But that is not the way the book continues at all. The Falling on the Bright Side title, I guess, was the clue that there was going to be a bright side. So let's start off by talking about some of the characters in the book. You have Larry, who is the central character. And Larry is working in this environment. It's challenging. He's busy. He's trying to do so much. He's also married, and he also has a child, and he has some difficulties in his personal life that are really interfering with his own personal satisfaction and career success and everything. He becomes involved with a very interesting cast of characters. And one of them is a gentleman who has had a stroke and is in the hospital. And there's a chapter in your book where you write from in the voice of this man who is he's hospitalized, he's had a stroke. He's not dead, he's not incommunicative, although most people are saying that he is. How were you able to develop that character? I found it quite intriguing, this whole chapter of how he was perceiving what was going on around him.
Well, they always say that a character is best if they come alive and they push the author away and just go their own way. So I think that character, Bill Foster, I modeled him after my friend Foster Hall, who I started Friends in Time with at least 20 years ago to provide services for people with neuromuscular diseases. And at some point in the middle, I decided his speech difficulties, which were important to the plot, shouldn't be like those of ALS, where, 'cause I wanted him to get better, which people with ALS really scarcely ever do, if ever. So then I got the idea of how about a left hemisphere stroke, because that can affect language. And with the help of a friend, Anne, who gave me a book, My Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolt Taylor.
Yes.
I read up on what it's like to have a left hemisphere stroke, which also Ram Dass had, the spiritual leader Ram Dass. So I read the book, and then I found her experience was that after she had the stroke, she had all these blissful feelings, and it took a lot for her to want to struggle back to the life she had had to even know that it existed. So the chapter 5 in the book that has Bill Foster waking up, kind of, but not even being sure if he's alive, and sort of swimming in these oceanic blissful feelings, but then having this misgiving that if he'd let it go, if he didn't struggle, he was going to give up everything he had known about life.
Right, right. That was very vivid, that you're sort of the reader's inside his head, and he's thinking this through, that I really need to fight back. I need to fight back to the surface. And if anybody listening, or you and I have been in the company of someone who's in a non-communicative state, at coma or whatever, it is just... It's almost inconceivable. It's very hard to imagine what's happening there. And so I was just quite fascinated by that chapter. And I found it very heartwarming, you know, that there is just, you know, so much more hope that you can have in those situations than a lot of people imagine. There was a point in the book where he was being reported as having died. And then, no, he wasn't dead. He was just in this hospital and had this stroke. And that sort of idea that this was such a, it was like dying. And then you read this chapter, and no, he's not even remotely dying. He is really gearing up in a way.
And I think one of the elements there is, like, the main character, Larry, finds it quite easy to believe that this person has died, like another character does. And I think our society finds it easy to believe that somebody who's stumbled, lost some faculty, isn't as sharp as they were, or has to use a wheelchair, that they've fallen off. They've fallen off the sort of the driven, anxious kind of society in which we live. That they don't have, they can't play the old role, so they don't have any role. And I think our nursing homes are full of such people who have been judged not able to contribute and therefore not able to belong to the society.
Yes, yes. In my past work, one thing that I would observe occasionally that really bothered me was when some very elderly resident was being spoken to in baby talk. And I just thought, you know... they're not children, you know. Perhaps they've lost some faculties, but this is a whole human being with a whole life history of experience. And there's just a pack of wisdom in there, even if it's not accessible. It happened, and I just think that it's important in those environments that training encourage people to make more observations. Another part of the book, another sort of line or theme, if you will, is this idea, the main character, Philip, who's feeling trapped in this job and his marriage is not working. I'm sorry, it's not Philip, it's Larry. There are a lot of characters in this book, and they're all very engaging. And so Larry is struggling. And this experience of going to the hospital and visiting Bill Foster, and what comes out of that in the observing, both in the choices he's making. You know, he's sort of straddling two jobs at one point. You know, he's been asked to become a counselor, but he still has the job with the paycheck back in the nursing home. And but he has training as a counselor. And so he's gone to meet this person who he would temporarily replace, who's had this left hemisphere stroke. And a theme that began, at least in my feeling, to evolve there was the sitting back and observing and listening and not rushing to reach conclusions. He's so baffled that anybody can understand what this man is saying and the sounds that he's making, okay, because he's had this left hemisphere stroke and it's affected his capacity to speak. And as the book continues, he begins to understand that that's possible if you really slow down and you really listen and you pay attention not just to what you're hearing, but what you're seeing and what you're feeling. And I was quite fascinated by that, is that another, does that draw from your own personal experience of working with people whose capacities are beginning to be challenged, that you've had to somehow learn to slow down and pay attention? Because you just mentioned the kind of type A society that we live in.
Yes, I think that comes from a lot of different elements of my own experience. Most specifically, the slowing down. My friend Foster, I'd taken walking meditation in various Zen retreats, but what stays in my mind is walking with Foster. We would hold each other's elbows, and I would walk backwards, and he would walk forwards while he still could walk. And it slowed me down so much to just be the support for his walking and his sort of trembling steps forward. And then the book has a lot about language and how... Because that's a big feature of ALS, that people who are gagging and having all kinds of physical problems, often their greatest loss is they can't communicate. That's the biggest loss for people who's very often. And so while Foster could still talk, I became his translator. He would use a computer to talk to a class of speech language pathologists, and they'd all be fascinated. And at the end, they would ask a question, and then Foster would make something in a very slurred way their eyes would dance back and forth because they couldn't understand it and embarrass them. Foster would look at me, and because we'd done a lot together over months and months, I could translate. And in a way, that's what Larry, the character in the book, got, that I also got with Foster, is by just linking up together, I was invited to be part of lectures to UNM students who are studying to be healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. Since I have no background in that, I would never have been invited. And for me, that taught me to slow down and listen, not to be in a rush to complete other people's thoughts, and just sort of creating opening to the shared space really expanded my experience in some way that's a bit mysterious even, but very palpable.
Yeah. I really liked that thread in the book of the slowing down and the listening and paying attention, because a lot of people don't. A lot of people have to learn to, as you say, let people finish their sentence and then wait and see if they have more to say. It's a very kind of Navajo paradigm for conversation, that you wait until the person who's speaking finishes, and then you continue to wait to make sure that they really are finished before you begin to speak. Because you listen all around you, people talking all over each other. You know, somebody's talking, somebody jumps right in. It's sort of like the talk show paradigm, which on television, where everybody is shouting and hollering and trying to be heard. And you don't get a message. You just get this sort of garbled, chaotic slew of words, but it's not very pleasing. In the book, you cited a Sufi story, and I'm just quickly looking here for that, because it seems to address what we were just talking about. Anyway, it was two gentlemen in a... Why don't you tell the story?
Right. The lame man and the blind man are in a tea house or a tavern, and they're both lamenting their inability to go to the annual emperor's feast, one because he's too crippled to walk, and the other because he's blind and he would walk off the edge of a cliff first turn in the path. And this wise man hears them complaining and lamenting their inability to go to this annual celebration. And in the actual story, he doesn't go up and talk to them, but he just observes to himself that the puny lame man could get on the shoulders of the robust blind man, and together they could walk along the path to the capital. And that's a story that makes a lot of sense to me, because I feel in my interaction with the disabled, they have always had a lot to teach me, and I always felt I was seeing, it gave me the opportunity to see the whole narrative arc of my own life, where for all of us as we get older, something maybe unwelcome awaits us, or at least a diminution of faculties, that if while we're still able to walk around, if we link up with somebody who's already had to encounter those difficulties, it makes it's reassuring. You know, you can meet these people who are doing just fine, although they have these obstacles to the life they used to live. So I felt I had a lot to learn, and I have been reassured that whatever awaits me, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Right. I think it was just it's a wonderful illustration. I found it particularly relevant for this show and a lot of what I talk about, which is the, you know, as you age and these things happen, that sort of mutual support, the collaboration, and also the willingness to accept help, which a lot of people find very difficult. I've had those conversations with other guests on the show, a geriatric care manager, for example, that a lot of people, you know, trying to help older parents that insist that they don't need help when obviously they are having some challenges in managing just the checkbook or the cooking or decision-making processes, whatever it is, that can be a difficult path. And I just love this illustration of like, okay, I can't see and you can't walk, but together we can get there. And by doing that together, we can really raise the quality of our life. We can do something that we thought we had to give up, but we don't. And it's that looking for solutions. And I thought it was a wonderful story, and it fit right into your book and the various plot lines of your book. Another theme that runs through it is forgiveness, which is something else that people often seem to address later in life. You have, again, the main character, Larry, who's very alienated from his father. His father is still living, but they haven't seen each other in 13 or 14 years. He suddenly receives this weird birthday card with some cash in it, and he's sort of not moved to respond to it in any way, but his wife is so annoyed that he's not trying. So initially, he makes an overture towards his father more because he's trying to appease the criticism coming from his wife. And then that relationship and that process just sort of goes off into a completely different direction, where it no longer is about just doing something because somebody else thinks he should, but he begins to work out what really played out there. What prompted you to weave that into this story?
Well, you could have asked me how autobiographical it was.
I could have asked you that. I thought, well, that's rather a cliche question. I'm not going to do that, but go ahead.
I think what might be autobiographical about it is that for many, many years, I had a lot of resentment about my own life. Not so much to blame somebody else for it, but I just felt like an alien in a society that I didn't understand. I think the forgiveness that takes place in the novel is a very important element of the novel, but it actually might be an example of, I started off with so many problems that nothing, there'd be no force in nature that could have fixed them except forgiveness. And I think that as I've got older, just accepting life as an opportunity to go forward and to try things and to appreciate what I've been given has come more and more to the fore. And I think in the context of the book, Larry's just so kind of out of whack that he needed to look around and see the people around him and appreciate life. And then the pain about things that happened as a child, for which he's blaming his father, had to come up, and it does. And that became the kind of the denouement of the novel.
Right. Well, you know, we're going to have to wrap up here, unfortunately. I obviously found this a very engaging book. If you tuned in recently, I am here with Michael Gray, author of Falling on the Bright Side, and indeed a very apt title. The beginning of the book lays out themes that one might find sad or depressing, and then it plays out in ways that are really very thought-provoking and inspiring. And I understand that your book is available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble, Falling on the Bright Side by Michael Gray. I want to thank you for being here today and let folks know that next week I will be talking to Toby Dichter in Philadelphia. She is the owner of an organization that they have an initiative called Sip and Swipe, where they go out, there's Sip and Swipe cafes, going out into locations, senior centers or nursing homes working with older adults to train them to use very simple tablet technology in order to communicate with either the people around them or also with family members. There's a lot happening with new technology that people are developing applications to be used by older adults. And so I think that's going to be a very interesting conversation. And so I really appreciate you all tuning in. I will be here next week talking to you. I'm Lori McGrath. This is Aging Reimagined. Thank you for being here, Michael.
Thank you for having me on the show. I enjoyed it a lot.
It was really good. Thank you. KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.